Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 28th of February. The news haunts us today from Chardon, Ohio. This report gives us the latest, and the information is somewhat incomplete because the story is being investigated. The shooting is being investigated as we speak. It comes, of course, from Chardon, Ohio. A second victim has died from wounds suffered in the school shooting in Chardon, Ohio. Authorities have yet to name the teen shooter arrested in the Monday morning attack, but many students, some of whom said they were steps away from the suspect when the bullets flew, described the shooter as a withdrawn boy named T.J. Lane. He's expected to make an initial court appearance at 3:30 this afternoon. The victims were students who attended Lake Academy Alternative School, which is a nearby vocational school, and they were waiting for a bus to take them there. According to witnesses, Lane himself is a student at the school for at-risk children, according to its interim director. With little to go on concerning who he is, of course, people went to Facebook and found postings by the alleged shooter for a glimpse into his mindset, especially a long, dark, poetic rant from December 30th. The post refers to a quaint, lonely town where there sits a man with a frown who longed for only one thing, the world to bow at his feet. He was better than the rest, all those ones he detests within their castles so vain, he wrote. He wrote about going through the castle like an ominous breeze through the trees, past guards all leading up to the post-dramatic conclusion. Feel death not just mocking you, not just stalking you, but inside all of you. Die, all of you. This hour of the program, we have two psychologists to talk about this shooting and to talk about violence in teens and bullying and a whole host of subjects. One of our guests writes, so you have a description of this alleged suspect. Now he has a gun. Why would he actually go through with harming anyone? Why doesn't he realize the awful seriousness of his actions and back away from them before he pulls out the gun, before he takes it out of his home even? Our phone number as we talk about these shootings is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Professor James Garbarino is a professor of psychology at Loyola University and author of Lost Boys, Why Our Sons Turn Violent and How We Can Save Them. Professor Garbarino, thank you so much for joining us this hour. And also joining us is Professor James Mazza, Professor of Educational Psychology and Director of the School Psychology Program at the University of Washington. Professor Mazza, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. This story broke yesterday when we were on the air, and I get a physical reaction to these stories, and I'm sure both of you must as well. They just make you cringe. You don't see them coming. They seem inexplicable, and they just fill us with complete horror.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Well, I think we're shocked and surprised, but every time this happens, people are shocked and surprised, and then we go back to sort of back to normal. But, you know, I think the starting point is to recognize that there are untold number of kids, particularly teenage boys around the country, who are sad, depressed, angry, ruminating, filling their heads with images, video games, Facebook, and so this to me is sort of the one pops up above the surface. But we should make no mistake, we can go a couple of years without a school shooting doesn't mean there aren't a lot of boys at that, just below that threshold, below that point of taking action.
You mentioned teenage boys. Why boys?
Well, I think it's partly that boys. Most boys have very limited means of expression. They easily get sort of diverted from social relationships, and they're awash in images of violent aggression as a solution to personal problems, for a start.
Professor Mazza, what do you think?
I would tend to agree with what Jim's just said. You know, our boys tend to have less coping strategies, and they have usually poor decision-making, those that are on the periphery. I think that we as a society, too, expect our boys to be stronger, and so they're supposed to solve their problems themselves, and they don't have the outlets to do that. And so I think they tend to be much more aggressive and violent towards themselves and outwardly.
You have written in your book, Professor Garbarino, the teen now has a gun. Why would he actually go through with harming anyone? Why doesn't he realize the awful seriousness of his actions?
Well, some of it is, you know, I think it's a combination of having an adolescent brain in his head and whatever else is going on. Now, adolescents do, their brains aren't fully developed. They don't have as much experience making decisions. And so we know that they do, you know, there was a case in Arizona I was involved in years ago where a boy, maybe not unlike this boy, had a lot of family troubles. And he somehow got in his head that the way to get help for his family was to go to school, take his classroom hostage at gunpoint, and that would do it. I mean, to an outside, to particularly to an adult brain, that seems like such a ridiculous premise. And, you know, there were a couple of boys in Michigan after Columbine who hatched a plot, 14 and 16-year-olds, where they were going to kidnap the principal and make him play rap music and then fly a plane into the World Trade Center. But on the other hand, you know, you've got teenage boys and teenagers who have all kinds of wild ideas. So the wild ideas part, in a way, is not so surprising given that they're teenagers. And then you add into it if they are depressed, if they are cut off and they develop this almost, you know, it's maybe too strong to call it a delusional system, but they have some wild ideas and anger. And then if you put a gun in their hands, it becomes lethal. I remember in Canada a while back they had a very similar kid, went to school, attacked his school, but all he could come up with was a knife, and so, you know, nobody died.
Mm-hmm. We hear this pattern of these young people being cut off. You hear again and again they're loners. Maybe they used to have friends, and their former friends come forward and say, well, we used to be friends, but then he became kind of strange and withdrawn. Is this a pattern that a lot of these young adolescents feel just completely cut off from everyone? They're just socially isolated, Professor Mazza?
Yeah, I think it is a pattern. You know, Jim made an earlier comment that, you know, with these school shootings pop up every year or so, and, you know, and once the emergency dies down or the crisis dies down, we kind of tend to forget about them. And, you know, that's not the case for the adolescents that are going through it. You know, we can show through our data that a lot of adolescents have mental health problems, and they're not good at making decisions. They don't have a lot of experience with what we call gray. So either things are all right or they're all wrong, and there's hardly anything in between. That's part of growing up. And so when they don't have those decision-making abilities and good coping strategies, throw in on top of that the mental health and then put a gun in their hand, I mean, it's a recipe for disaster in that case.
You know, the other thing we might add is the New York Times did a study a number of years ago on mass murderers, and the only real difference they found between teenagers and adults was that adults really tend to be loners in the sense that they don't telegraph what they're about to do to others, whereas most of the teenagers, maybe, you know, the overwhelming majority of teenagers, have some social support for what they do in the sense that there's somebody, either in person or online, who is validating what they do. I mean, remember, after the Columbine school shooting, some kid somewhere started a website called the Church of Dylan and Eric, two boys in the Columbine school shooting, and they got thousands of hits, most of them affirmative. I can understand why they did it. I don't have the guts to do it. And in many of these cases, there is someone, in fact, it's usually someone who has some inkling of this, even direct knowledge, but for a variety of reasons. Again, after the Columbine, I think within a year, they polled high school seniors and asked if a kid you knew talked about killing someone, would you tell an adult? And about two-thirds said no. So that is part of the disconnect here, even now.
Why would that be? Two-thirds say no?
Well, I think it's partly because there's an ethic of don't rat on your friends, don't get them in trouble. Sometimes they don't trust that adults will respond to it in a way that they see helpful and supportive. I'm involved in a case in Wisconsin right now, right in the state I think you're in, where two teenagers, 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, hatched a plot, a mutual suicide plot. They partly went through it, and the local prosecutor, neither kid died, but the local prosecutor is charging one of the kids as an adult with attempted first-degree murder. I mean, that kind of knowledge that that's the way adults respond, some of them, not as a mental health crisis would give you pause. And also, I think the other thing is that there's so much, you know, the culture has become so vividly and mordantly violent and sort of warped that it's hard to pick out which kids are just mouthing off and which kids are seriously troubled. Mm-hmm. That's changed over 40 years, to be sure.
I read, I don't know if you heard, the CNN report of the Facebook message that this alleged shooter put on Facebook back on December 30th. If you were reading that Facebook message, it sounds pretty threatening and quite ominous. I guess you wonder, we have to wonder because we want things to change, who should have looked at that and done something, and what should they have done?
Well, I know I'm sort of speaking too much here on the phone, but I think, you know, training kids to report that to some adult they trust and then building up the expectation that it will be handled in a humane, compassionate way, not in a heavy-handed way and immediately getting involved in adult prosecutions and things. Kids are never going to report. That's why they allow a lot of drug abuse to go by. I think the first line of defense always has to be kids because they are mostly the ones for whom these messages are leaked. I mean, I don't know how many adults read that message, but I'm sure a lot of kids did. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think in the CNN story, the report is, you know, there were several kids who sort of responded in a kindly way. We know what you're going through, you know, but they don't take the step of making a connection. I mean, that happened in Columbine as well. It's happening more and more often because social media have become the marketplace. In this Wisconsin case with the joint suicide, there was stuff on Facebook these two kids had exchanged about this.
Professor Mazza.
Yeah, I agree with what Jim said. You know, this youngster, at least in the Ohio case, was already at an alternative school. And so part of my belief and philosophy is that, you know, education has to be academics plus coping skills and decision-making abilities. We've got plenty of kids that are in our juvenile jails that can pass our academic high-stakes testing but don't make good decisions. And so, to me, that's part of the education process. This kid was already identified as struggling. And so, to me, you know, having to go to his Facebook page, my guess is that there were warning signs way before that this kid had already been identified. And so we should be keeping an eye on these types of kids in our alternative settings or who are coming up, you know, at risk on some of our assessment instruments that we have, and keep following them. We don't emphasize mental health services in our schools at all for our adolescents these days, and we know that they're experiencing a lot of mental health stresses.
Amen to that. I couldn't agree more with that. And the other thing is people always sound so, you know, people are bad readers of other people's intentions in this area. Over and over again, you hear people say, well, you know, he's a sweet kid, nice kid, although that may be true. But the disconnect between that and what they do is so dramatic. From what little is available, again, I think we're all relying on CNN here, is this kid sounded like he had a horrendous life. Both his parents involved in domestic violence. His father involved in repeated assaults against women and girlfriends. Mm. He's living with his grandparents because he can't live with his parents. All of those are risk factors in their own right. And, you know, as has been said, if he's already in an alternative school because he's been identified as high risk, you can't go on the sort of, mostly you can't go on the demeanor because, you know, in some ways the most troubled kids are the ones who've internalized. There was another case I was involved in years ago where, you know, boy, he came to school on Valentine's Day, a senior in high school, with a bag full of bombs and two guns, mulling over whether he should just kill himself because he was such a loser or take out his tormentors. And, you know, this is a kid who had been to the guidance counselor and been told there's nothing we can do about the bullying, you know, you got to handle it yourself. This is a kid who the day before in the school bus was looking out the window, making a sort of pistol out of his finger and picking out tormentors. But, you know, again, people were shocked and surprised because he was such a quiet kid.
I wonder, you mentioned mental health services, considering what's happening with cutbacks for nurses in a lot of schools and budget cuts happening right and left. I wonder how many mental health services that are pretty complete are around in high schools these days. Are they adequate?
You know, from my opinion, probably not. You know, I think that there's not been much of an emphasis nationally or even at the state levels of providing mental health services, and a lot of our, and you know, I don't fault the schools for that. They're the personnel that are in the schools don't have the mental health training, and so you know it's not in part of the curriculums that are going at they're at these graduate schools or at these teacher education programs, and so you know teachers aren't aware of those signs. The school psychologist is probably your best filter for the mental health problems, and you know there's three schools for every school psychologist, and so I think that makes it a really difficult type of situation to provide these mental health needs for kids.
Mm-hmm. How difficult is it? I know there is no school at the high school today. How difficult is it for a community and for a school and for students to be able to take all of this in? I would think that it's just incredibly traumatic.
Well, you know, it is. And the good news is that, by and large, kids who are exposed to one acute trauma, whether it's 9/11 or something like this, particularly if they get sort of psychological first aid, which they probably will, that you know, within 6 to 8 months, overwhelmingly they will be back to where they were. And from other, you know, other situations, it's kids who are already vulnerable before this happens, kids whose parents are going through a divorce, kids who were depressed to start with, kids whose dog died, whatever it is. They tend to have more difficulty, and the closer you are to the actual event, the kids who are in the room with them, the kids who were sitting next to somebody, so that proximity of distance and psychological connection, all that raises the risk. But you know, but overall, I think the sort of the prognosis is generally pretty good for most of the kids after this. The other big thing is the question, you know, how does the community respond? There have been communities that have responded by embracing the kids who've done this as a troubled member of their community and rallying around their families. There are other communities, as in the case of Columbine, where the parents start getting death threats and there's a wall of denial, starting from the principal of the school on down, that, you know, this was one crazy kid, has nothing to do with the social climate in our school. So the community response sometimes can be as important as the individual psychological response of the kids.
We welcome phone calls. Our lines are filled. Let me give you the number. You will eventually be able to get through, 800-486-8655. Our guest this hour, Professor James Mazza, Professor of Educational Psychology and Director of the School Psychology Program at the University of Washington. Professor James Garbarino, Professor of Psychology at Loyola University, author Lost Boys, Why Our Sons Turn Violent, and How We Can Save Them. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your calls, starting with Andy in Lake Geneva. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I think the good news here is that it surprises me when people express shock at this. I think it is an absolute miracle, consistent with what your guests are saying, that this is not much more widespread, that we don't have these incidences almost every other week. When you take a look at the saturation of violence, this well-armed nation, the ability to get a gun no matter who you are or what you are, all this sexual stuff, the whole Facebook bullying thing, and then just the adolescent experience, it's a veritable miracle that we're not having, that this is not much more widespread. So I just sort of get a giggle, frankly, with tears in my eyes when people say, oh, my goodness, look at this. I mean, if we really sit back and look at what's coming at these children, and that's what they are, children from this society, it's just a miracle we don't have more of it, consistent with what your guests are saying or all the various touch points going on and getting these children.
Professor Garbarino.
I think that, you remember years ago I was on a panel and somebody said, who do you point the finger of blame at? And I said, well, you need, you know, two hands worth of fingers, because each element contributes to this. It's like you're building a tower of blocks and you put one more block on top and the tower falls over. You don't really want to say that block caused it, because you realize there are all these teetering towers. And I think the caller identifies a number of these elements in it. And part of the problem is, in the wake of this, a lot of interest groups begin to get in a sort of defensive pattern, and they won't acknowledge that they are part of the issue. That panel I was on, you know, there was somebody from the movie industry, and they said, you know, honestly, we should take a finger of responsibility. Until we got, and then went on until we got to the head of the NRA, and he said, well, we're not taking any finger of responsibility. That is indicative of part of why we have this problem, that these agents who are pursuing interest, which often have financial interest, as in the case of the NRA and the gun lobby, as in the case of the media industry that promotes violent images, and on it goes. So, you know, there's a need to accept collective responsibility for this because it is an accumulation of risk that produces these events. But the accumulation is always simmering there in large numbers. And you know, as the other, as Mazza said, you know, these mental health problems are not being dealt with effectively, partly because of cutbacks, partly because of this attitude that you know, this kid will probably refer to as a gunman, as if he's a man. When I was in court yesterday in Kenosha, Wisconsin, you know, there's talk about Mr. So-and-so. These aren't Mr. So-and-so. These aren't adult gunmen. These are troubled kids. And until the whole society looks at the troubled kids, we'll constantly swing from doing nothing to now, you know, life imprisonment for hundreds of thousands of teenagers. That's part of the craziness. It's not the controlling issue, but it is a contributor.
Mm-hmm. Professor Mazza, when we look at these various elements, the increase in violence and video games and movies and not looking at availability, accessibility of guns, are these new elements in our society, or have they always been with us? Is there something that's causing a crisis now?
Well, that's a good question. So the element of gun ownership has probably been with us for a long time. The element of kids getting a hold of guns seems to me to be a little bit more recent in the last 20 to 30 years, especially the handguns, which, you know, we see as being quite easily accessible, deadly. And then I think, though, that the intersection of some of the variables that our adolescents are experiencing, so dating, sexual orientation, peer rejection, colleges, university successes, financial crisis. So all those things are interacting together. And when kids don't have those decision-making abilities to sort through them, or they don't have their parents at home to help them figure some of those things out, then they start making decisions based on the limited knowledge that they have. And again, if your limited knowledge is all white or all black or all right and all wrong, you know, it's the caller's right that, you know, you're surprised that there's not more of these things happening.
Can I just add, too, that, you know, the research in the military has found that something like 85 to 90% of males come with a sort of built-in inhibition to killing, which is why, you know, World War II research showed that only about 10% of regular soldiers, when in their combat, could point their rifle and shoot.
Yes.
And kill an enemy. And they discovered in the military that the most efficient way to break down that inhibition is the point-and-shoot video game. So again, it's not that playing a point-and-shoot video game causes you to kill, but it removes one of the impediments, because it's very hard to go in with a gun and shoot people if you haven't had that inhibition broken down. In Columbine, those kids practice for hours on video games, pointing and shooting. It's been a factor in probably most of the school shootings. We haven't heard about it yet with this boy. But the point is that, you know, the military knows that they're creating a vulnerability, and so they compensate by a chain of command and teaching a very strong ethic about responsible use of your weapon. That's what the gun culture did sort of in the past. But the gun culture in the past, they were shooting targets. To some degree, they're shooting animals. There's a distinct difference when you practice shooting human forms on a screen with a handheld gun that enables you to kill if you get to the rest of the story about that. Be interesting to see if this boy has that.
Let's go to Maureen in La Crosse. Hi, Maureen.
Good morning. I wanted to share, I'm a mental health therapist, and a colleague and I have been working with adolescents, actually at middle school and high school level. With area schools, we have an agreement that we can see the children on site. So during their school day, they miss less time. Parents don't have to take off work to drive them to an appointment and back. So we have higher attendance with sessions. The schools are not liable in any way for the therapy nor for the cost, because as licensed therapists, we bill their standard insurance. And it's been just a really good solution.
Thanks, Maureen. Professor Mazza?
Yeah, I think that is great. That's actually someone that's going out there being proactive, knowing kids have some of these issues, and it's getting out in front of the ball, so to speak, so it doesn't roll down the hill too fast. And so kids that are able to stay in school means that they're not out on the streets, they're not dropping out of school, they're not using drugs, they're not, you know, getting involved in maybe the wrong group of peers. And so I think the more you can keep kids bonded to schools, and we've got research that shows that out here in Seattle, that if kids can stay bonded to school, they tend to make better decisions, they tend to stay in school, and by staying in school, they tend to be more likely to graduate. And so I think that, again, you can see how those things all interact together, and if you can get on the side of interacting well, it kind of cycles up, and if you get on the side of interacting poorly, it cycles down. And so I think that's a great response.
Bill in Madison, hi.
Yes, I dispute with what the guests and a lot of the people calling in are saying in terms of some of their basic assumptions. I grew up in the 50s and 60s. I was a bullied kid. I was lonely. In fact, I went through periods where I felt suicidal. I grew up in the South. There were guns all around me, including in my own house. Everybody is a rite of passage. Every 10-year-old boy got a .22 rifle. Our home situation was not ideal. So anyway, I had all the elements. And I used to fantasize all kinds of horrible ways to kill my tormentors. But yet, even as a 12-year-old, I remember thinking, well, if I went through with this, it would really shame my family. It would end my life. I would end up either in jail or in some mental facility. My going to a decent college would certainly be out of the question. Basically, if I lived to be 100 years old, I would still be that guy who did that. And in other words, I was able to reason out the consequences of my actions. And I was able to decide that this was, as much as I would love to see these guys die horribly, it was just not something I could act on.
All right, Bill, thank you. Professor Garbarino?
Well, you know, part of the response would be, I'm so appreciative that you were able to take that path. You know, my mother is 87 and has smoked all her life. She's the healthiest person I know. We still know that smoking is bad for your health. It accounts for, you know, smoking accounts for about 10-15% of the variations in lung cancer. TV violence accounts for about the same proportion, about 10-15% of aggressive behavior in kids. Obviously, most kids who watch TV don't behave violently, but on average, it has that effect. We're always talking about on average, and we're talking about the accumulation of factors. And of course, in the caller's story, given the historical context, the media exposure and the exposure to violent video games was very different. And I also point out, the South has had higher murder rates than the rest of the country since there was a country. So, even saying that, obviously most Southerners are not murderers, but there are things in Southern culture that have been associated with much higher murder rates for a long time. The research on guns and murder is pretty weak in the sense that there's no direct connection. Where there is much more of a connection is between accessibility of guns and suicide. And most of these school shooters have a suicidal element to them. Either they do try to take their life, or they're engaging in what they call, you know, suicide by cop. Some of them have, you know, berated themselves. They weren't strong enough to kill themselves. So the suicidal link to guns and depressed people is very strong. But again, obviously not every depressed person commits suicide. Not every suicide is a depressed person. We're always talking about, as we are in the case of smoking, there are exceptions. There's a general rule, and then there are particularly vulnerable individuals who, you know, there are people who the odds of them getting cancer if they smoke are very, very high because they have genetic vulnerability to that. So it is a complex picture, and individual stories don't rule in or rule out the general phenomenon.
Could we take on, because we hear from Bill's call and from many cases like this, the element of being tormented, of being bullied. How does that affect the adolescent? How widespread is that? How do we change that? And how important is it in all of these kinds of shootings?
Well, I think that it is important. Again, I think it's one element. Jim is an expert in the bullying field. For suicide, we know that, you know, a lot of our suicide victims have felt rejected, have been victims of bullying, and so that it becomes another element, another place where the self-esteem or self-concept really is falling off, and it provides a feeling of nobody cares about me, my life's not worth living. And then you have to interact that with, you know, some of the mental health issues that go on, like being depressed or having obsessive-compulsive disorder, and then family support. So if the lack of support's there, that safety net is kind of gone, and they fall much further.
You know, when the Secret Service and the FBI did their investigation of school shootings a number of years ago in the wake of the Columbine, you know, when we had a rash of this, they concluded that bullying was directly involved in something like 80-85% of all of those cases. And again, it makes sense why. Listening to your caller before, the pain and suffering is very common. I think the research says about 70% of kids have a direct connection with bullying, either as being a bully, being a victim, or being a bystander. So it's a very widespread phenomenon. It's been tolerated. It's even been approved of in some settings. At Columbine High School, you know, there was implicit approval by adults for bullying gay and lesbian kids. Gay and lesbian kids across the country have been much more targeted than straight kids, and often with the implicit, if not the explicit, support of adults. You can hear that in a political campaign when you give license to degrade or diminish somebody because of who they are. You're sending an implicit message, this is okay to do. So bullying, you know, does play a big role in this. Most kids don't snap, but most kids suffer from it. And as Mazza said, it's often very implicated in suicidal behavior because kids feel desperate. And part of the problem is high school seems like it's the whole world to a lot of teenagers. You know, one sort of, it's a almost a futile thing to suggest, but if they could just be patient and realize
a few years
from now, you're going to look back and say, you know, go see Back to the Future or something and see,
right.
See how silly in retrospect some of that is. But of course, at the moment, you can't see that, particularly as a teenager, where it is your whole world, where your capacity to project into the future is often somewhat diminished, where you're struggling, as was said, with decision-making and hormones and relationships, and again, it's a wonder more kids don't do terrible things, given how badly so many of them feel.
Taylor in Rushford, Minnesota. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, thanks for the show. When something like this happens, I immediately think of the documentary that Michael Moore did about Columbine, and there's a lot of reasons I think people go so. I don't want to say wacko, but go out of their way to pull something like this off. But one of the big ones I picked up out of that movie is the way America is infatuated with war and violence. You can't turn on the TV now and not turn on a news station or even a movie station and not see America at war, killing people with drones and whatnot and what else, or turn on the TV and see a movie where someone is not killing somebody else. And we've been at war this entire kid's life, and you know, he's turned on the TV and all he's heard about is war and violence and us killing, and is somewhere it's got to stop. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think the way it's going now, we're just going to have a bigger infatuation with war and violence, and it's only getting worse.
And, you know, I think the caller makes a good point. There is some research that shows after you have a war, there's sort of an echo of violence within your home country. And as the caller points out, we've been sort of continuously at war with somebody somewhere, you know, for decades and decades and decades. So that does spill over. The message that, you know, I do a lot of work as an expert witness in death penalty cases, and I would say over 25 years, almost every killer I've ever met and interviewed, at the time they commit the act, they believe they're justified in doing it. They may, you know, see it differently later on, but the point is, once you validate killing as a solution to problems, it's very hard to control that. And you say, well, you know, we have very good reasons for that and so on. But somebody else says, well, they killed for a good reason. I've got a good reason. And it, you know, again, particularly adolescents may be particularly prone to this. I remember interviewing kids in prison after one of the big American attacks somewhere. I can't remember which attack it was. But they were sort of saying, well, you know, we understand that because in our neighborhood you've got to retaliate and you've got to keep respect. And you, and they saw validation from the American government for what they had done criminally. It may seem like a stretch to people, but I think it's often quite real. And the caller has put his finger on something. You know, Mahatma Gandhi said, you know, or various teachers have said, you know, there is no way to peace. Peace is the way. And the more you promote peaceful life, the less violence you get. And as the caller points out, we are awash in politically violent rhetoric as well as all the images. It's an uphill fight in many ways.
How do you, and I know you've written about this as part of your book, but how do you reclaim those young boys that you were talking to in prison? How do we reclaim people who have had violent kinds of thoughts or who have done violent actions but didn't kill themselves and who are still with us? How do we get people to change their path in life and make changes?
Well, you know, I think the irony in this is that in most of the cases, the kids who have committed these school shootings would actually be very good candidates for rehabilitation because it so often is not linked to a long sort of emerging criminal history in childhood and adolescence. It's the result of a mental health crisis in adolescence. So I'm saying ironically because we typically then charge them as adults, give them terms of 100 years, 200 years. You know, the surviving school shooters are all over the country in prisons, but they could have been easily rehabilitated. I'll give you an example, this case in Michigan, where, you know, I was involved with a 14-year-old boy who was part of this plot, the school attack plot. The local prosecutor wanted to try him as an adult for, you know, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. Eventually, he was sort of forced into trying him as a juvenile. The kid went to a juvenile facility for 18 months. By then, he had recovered from this crisis with therapy and counseling and support. He went back to high school and graduated on time. So this is a group that, you know, obviously when people have been killed, the magnitude of the offense makes people say, you know, we can't let them get away with this. But it's very different when you're talking about somebody who's come up year after year with aggression and bad behavior and violence, and then the adolescents that are involved in this. I mean, that's most of whom is in prison. That's most of the people I've dealt with. That can be done, but again, it often takes a lot longer time of cognitive behavioral therapy and support. Often developing their spiritual development and their spiritual life is an important part of that. I was involved in three guys recently who committed murders at 16 and now 16 years later are paroled. And at least a couple of them were ready to go out much earlier, but it was because they went through this transformative process. So that's the good news. The bad news are that some kids are so damaged by the time they come into adolescence that it's a Herculean task to rehabilitate them. But sending them to life imprisonment is just ridiculous in so many ways, and trying them adults often is ridiculous. And it's often under the political agenda of local prosecutors who want to look tough on crime.
Mm-hmm. Professor Mazza, here's a Facebook comment from Shelley. I'm wondering why we don't hear about these types of incidents happening as much in other first world countries as they happen here.
Yeah, well, so I think that our U.S. media picks up on the U.S. Incidents probably a little bit more, and the sensationalism, like the caller was talking about, I think really is kind of easy pickings or low fruit on the tree for our media outlets. We have seen, though, some school shootings in Germany and some of the other countries, which, you know, we didn't used to see before Columbine. So this isn't just a situation that's happening here in the United States. Back to Jim's point, too, you know, I think that a lot of these adolescents are good candidates for rehabilitation. They don't have this long history, as Jim had talked about. Plus, they were already identified within our system, and we kind of missed them. The system didn't do its job in my eyes, you know, so that they were identified. We should have been getting these kids help, putting safety nets underneath them and helping them with their coping strategies and decision-making, you know, through cognitive behavior therapy or dialectical behavior therapy. So, you know, Dylan and Eric, the two shooters at Columbine, They were also suicidal, and they had already been captured as being at risk in eighth grade. So, again, it's not like we don't know that these things should catch us by total surprise. These kids have already been identified, and so we're not following through with the right services for these kids once we've identified them.
Jack in Eagle River, hi.
Yeah, hi. Two things. The first thing is I remember a kid that I went to school with who was being bullied, and he'd come home and he'd cry and whatnot, and his uncle or somebody said, you should get boxing lessons. And it worked. I mean, it's not going to work for everybody, but that guy learned how to defend himself, and that's, you know, bullies are cowards. So that was very effective. That's just kind of like an aside. What I wanted to bring out is, I'm surprised somebody hasn't mentioned this, the role that participation in sports might play in giving them an outlet for whether it's hostility or violence or whatever. And it doesn't have to be interscholastic. It can even be intramural sports where they get out, they're active, they're busy, you know. What do you think of that?
Thanks, Jack, for the call.
Sports work good ways. One, they provide a peer group, an innate peer group that's right there, kind of a team type of approach, if it's like basketball or football or baseball. And so you've got colleagues right there or peers right there to kind of provide a safety net. If it's things like golf or even individual sports that the person can get out and do things and find some accomplishment and find some success at it, they're less likely to get impacted by some of that bullying because they've got something to turn to that's a strength of theirs. And so I think having peer activities, whether it's sports or clubs that are after school and so forth, I think getting kids involved in those things and in social situations is usually pretty supportive, or what we call a buffer.
And what about, you hear this frequently, Professor Garbarino, you need to learn how to defend yourself, take up boxing, learn how to fight back.
Well, you know, it's a mixed bag, I think. Certainly anything that promotes a sense of discipline and self-confidence, and projecting, you know, a sort of calm, assertive presence can probably help. Of course, you know, most of the violence that takes place in schools is not in these schools like the one we're talking about today. It involves kids in schools with a lot of troubled kids, a lot of kids dealing with broken families and poverty, where fighting is something they really know how to do. So, you know, it may be in some cases, even martial arts may work to provide a discipline, but you have to look at the larger context, because in some areas the problem is not lack of experience with fighting. It's quite the opposite, where fighting becomes a principal mechanism of conflict resolution. It's a bit like sports. You know, sports in the hands of good coaches can have all these positive benefits and generally did. I look back at my high school career and sports was very, very important. But, you know, coaching can turn kids towards bullying and create bullying. And some of the hazing that has gone on, you know, by sports-related activities has been implicated in some of the problems that we've seen. So, you know, very few things work one way, all the same way, everywhere, for everyone. It depends on what it actually means. And that goes to the U.S. as a whole. A couple of callers ago talking about, yes, we do have had school shootings in other societies, but there, you know, in general, the homicide rate in the United States, you know, is in multiply times higher
mm-hmm.
than it is most of these other first countries. And some of that has to do with economic inequality, because, again, most of the killing that is done is not done by these school shooters. It's done by kids at the bottom of society who are full of rage mm-hmm. and who can traumatize themselves. And we do sort of lead the world in that, because we are one of the world's first world leaders in inequality. Couple that with access to guns, couple that with the punitive juvenile justice system, and on it goes. It's an unfortunate thing for us. We know we have a higher rate of incarceration than virtually any country in the world. It rivals Russia under the Soviet Union and the gulags. And our rate of incarceration is many times higher than other societies. And then once you put somebody in prison, you're increasing the risk of future violence in many, many ways for them. So it's a complex network that America as a system has a lot to answer for.
More phone calls in a moment. This hour we're talking about the tragic school shooting in Chardon, Ohio. It claimed another life overnight, the death toll 2 now, and were once again responding to how could this happen? Why were there not signs detected earlier? How could it have been totally prevented? What about violence in our society? All of that. Big discussion. 800-486-8655. Our guests are Professor James Garbarino, Professor of Psychology at Loyola University, author Lost Boys, Why Our Sons Turn Violent and How We Can Save Them, Professor James Mazza, Professor of Educational Psychology and Director of the School Psychology Program at the University of Washington. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, this book actually was named by the New York Times as one of the 10 best of last year. Manny Mirabal's book on Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Manny spent many years writing this book and unfortunately died before it was published, although he did see the galleys of the book before he died. Two of the editors of Malcolm X will be joining us, hour two of our show. All right, back to phone calls. Tim in Mount Calvary. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm very glad to be on your show, and I'm and your two guests. We put on a peer helper workshop, and we've been doing it since 1982. And we train students to listen to other students and not just their peers. It's locker-to-locker counseling, and we train them to listen. We talk to them about the drug and alcohol stuff. We talk about domestic violence. And this year we had them listen to a speaker on cyberbullying. And we train the kids to listen to the kids, because a lot of these students that are troubled aren't going to go to the adults. But we train the kids and teach them how to, because there are counselors from every school that sends kids to this workshop, and they have to know where to go in terms of this, because they don't always know.
Who is the
list of helping agencies in their communities?
And who's the we? Are you a counseling service?
I'm a retired teacher, and I bring together counselors to do this.
Oh,
from different schools, we bring different counselors in from different schools to do this.
Uh huh.
Yes.
All right. Send us more information. We'd be interested in a show like this down the road, Professor Mazza.
Yeah, so I think that's a great idea, and you know, more times than not, our kids do turn to other kids first. As Jim had talked about earlier in the show, that you know, our adolescents usually find adults to be pretty judgmental and not understanding where they're coming from. And although we'd like to say, geez, just wait, you'll understand what this is like, 3 or 4 years from now, that's not the reality for where our kids are. I mean, the reality is that they're living, you know, at 15 and 16 years old, and that's what matters to them today, not at 19 and 20. So I think that's really important that you do train kids. My only concern with that type of message is that as long as we teach our kids that they're not responsible for another kid's life. And so when it comes to kids who are have violent ambitions or who are suicidal, that peer helper needs to know that they have to get adult help. And so that would be my only caveat to that strategy.
Thank you, Tim. Tammy in Superior, hi.
Hi, I've been hearing a lot of talk about how we should educate our teachers and our school professionals to be able to recognize these problems, how the peers of these children should feel comfortable going to adults, but I've not heard any talk yet about the responsibility of the parents. I was a support person at a school. We had an incident where a young man showed violence tendencies. He made comments on the bus, wanted to hurt people. And instead of the parents becoming actively involved to find out what was disturbing this boy, they wanted to take legal action against the school because of the school's actions to protect the other students. And I think there's a big disconnect here where it's everyone else's responsibility but the parents.
Thank you, Tammy. Professor Garbarino.
Well, I understand the feeling, and at one level, of course, that's true. Parents can play, should play a much bigger role. But, you know, one of the things we tend to do in response to this is to say, well, if parents did their job better, this wouldn't happen. That may be true, but it may be an ineffectual, almost irrelevant approach, because if we have to wait until we get all the parents in America on board on this, you know, we can have this conversation in 10 years and 20 years and 30 years. We had the same conversation after Columbine. I think it's worth pursuing, but anyone who wants to put all their eggs in the basket of parents, among other things,
you know, this case, you know, I've been involved in cases like the one you're talking about, but there are times, and it's quite common, where parents don't know, not because they're hiding their head in the sand, but because kids are really good at hiding stuff from them. That happens, certainly. I think that one big change is that the schools are often on the defensive by parents who would rather sue the school and blame the school rather than take any responsibility themselves. So I'm not denying that that's important. I'm just saying that there have been people who said, we don't need to do any of these other things about guns and video games and media because it's all in the hands of parents. To me, that's guaranteed to be a losing strategy because the kids most in need of effective parents are least likely to have them. And that sounds like, from the initial reports, what this case in Cleveland, in Ohio, is speaking to. You could blame these parents or hold them accountable, but they were not in a position to do much about this.
Thank you.
Counting on them would be useless.
Thank you so much. It was an important hour. It's in the hands of all of us, isn't it? Our thanks to our guests for an important discussion of the aftermath of the school shooting in Ohio. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this show, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios. We'll return.